I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the Donald Rumsfeld Hour, if you can stand it. Errol Morris's movie, The Unknown Known, is the provocation here. Cinema sequel to the Oscar-winning documentary on Robert McNamara in Vietnam, The Fog of War. The Rumsfeld questions implied by Morris, but unanswered in the movie, begin with who Rumsfeld was and what he was up to. How has the experience of a $3-5 trillion catastrophe sailed past any apparent reflection or rethinking on the part of the Iraq War's architect? He spent 33 hours talking into Errol Morris's camera, an exercise in cheerful deflection, denial, and a good deal of distortion of the checkable record, including his own public memos and comments. So, the questions come back to us. What is it about American politics and media and our private consciences that has gotten us accustomed to relentless prosecution of high-risk truth-tellers about that war? Chelsea Manning comes to mind, formerly Bradley Manning. When the principals in the war are still parading a blithe disregard for all they wrought. Here, for example, is Donald Rumsfeld rereading to Errol Morris one of those famous snowflake memos in the Pentagon, parsing what was taken as strategic philosophy.
You want me to read this?
Yes, please.
February 4th, 2004. Subject: What You Know. There are known knowns. There are known unknowns. There are unknown unknowns. But there are also unknown knowns. That is to say, things that you think you know that it turns out you did not.
Nothing there from Donald Rumsfeld about the truths that have unfolded since then and are now all too well known. Nothing about the American limp in the world. What is to make of this man Rumsfeld after so much damage has been done? And aren't we all waiting for a reckoning, well, beyond a movie? The writer Mark Danner, burrowing relentlessly through the Rumsfeld record, also the records of Dick Cheney and George W. Bush on the Iraq War team for the New Yorker Review of Books. Mark Danner gets our conversation started. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who was Colin Powell's right hand in the State Department in the Bush administration, is here too. And Steve Kinzer, the writer, foreign correspondent, Middle East war reporter, and historian of the hot and covert wars that flowed out of the long Cold War. Mark Danner, you've seen the Rumsfeld movie. You could have written it deeper. What are moviegoers going to make of this man? A Depression baby, born 1932, a Princeton wrestler, congressman from the Chicago suburbs, staff darling of Richard Nixon in the White House, patron of young Dick Cheney, and Cheney's partner ever since. What was it he became?
Well, I think that the viewers will probably find this particular Rumsfeld, since he speaks after the disaster of the Iraq War and various other Bush administration policies have become evident, they'll find him very frustrating because, as you observed, he admits no error. He provokes or at least offers no reconsideration. He offers the same sunny, pragmatic, Midwestern, faux philosophical face to the world that he's offered since he got out of college and became a young congressman from Illinois and very quickly entered the Nixon administration and rose like a rocket to White House Chief of Staff under Ford and then Secretary of Defense and then returned in that job under George W. Bush. And it's the same old Rumsfeld. It's not a new Rumsfeld. He does offer to us not a reconsideration of the decisions he made, but a kind of philosophical I couldn't even call it a self-analysis. It's a philosophical self-exculpation, although he doesn't put it in those terms. You played the clip of him reading his the heart of his philosophy, which Errol Morris encapsulates in the movie's title. But one of the things I was trying to show in my pieces for the New York Review is that if you actually look at his application of this philosophy, you find it's kind of a Ponzi scheme, sort of a con game. He tells us, for example, that a good example of a unknown unknown, something we don't know and we don't even know we don't know it, is the attacks of 9/11. And in fact, even a cursory look at the record shows that there was an enormous amount of concern within the government, including within the Pentagon, that attacks were coming. The bureaucracy, just even despite the fact that high-level officials like Rumsfeld didn't pay very much attention to this, people within the bureaucracy, counterterrorism officials like Richard Clark and others, were enormously concerned and tried to shake the tree and get their principals to pay attention. And it's very likely, or at least quite possible, that had they succeeded in that, that those attacks would have been prevented. So you have this use of unknown unknown. That is, we didn't know it, and we didn't even know what we didn't know, as a kind of shield beyond which Rumsfeld and his colleagues, frankly, but Rumsfeld especially, can hide his own lack of curiosity and his own mistakes and his own failure to protect the country from his job as Secretary of Defense. And we see this repeatedly.
Yeah, you strike that note. I mean, an intellectual after fashion and a sort of invincibly ignorant man of almost no meaning. I mean, you're a writer, Mark Danner. Speak about his obsession with words. 20,000 memos in his career at the Pentagon. And yet he can maybe the most famous line in all of them was saying on the matter of enhanced interrogation to sort of keep men in standing positions for a long time. And he wrote in his own hand, on somebody else's memo, I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing time limited to 4 hours? Initials DR. Now, I bring it up just because he is, then he pretends, oh, those words didn't mean anything. I probably shouldn't have written them down. I don't know why I did. But he was obviously giving a signal that anything goes.
Yes, I think he was. And, you know, it's a remarkable demonstration of, again, the sort of flim-flam notion of much of what he wrote down, the notion that a man, a Secretary of Defense, standing in his own vast office at his desk, drinking coffee, writing memos, having meetings, making phone calls, is in some way comparable to some naked, hooded figure in a freezing room.
Not to mention a dog at his vitals, you know, I mean...
Yes, and chained to the, bolted to the floor, unable to move for 4 hours without pause. So the notion that these things are in any way remotely comparable is ridiculous, but it did seem to be a signal, I agree, to do whatever is needed. And that's certainly the way it was taken down the line by people who read the memo. I think it's important, you know, you said a moment ago, you talked about his love of words, and also the emptiness of the ideas. And I think a couple things are important to point out. One is that he's a very intelligent man. There's no question about that. It seems to me, you know, he made one of the most intelligent comments to come out of the Bush administration regarding the war on terror in one of his snowflakes. You know, are we killing, capturing, deterring more terrorists every day than the mullahs are producing in their madrasas? That's a paraphrase, but it describes the dynamic of the war and summarizes it very, very concisely. His problem wasn't intelligence. It seems to me it was a kind of ambitious arrogance, lack of self-questioning for all of his memos, and his refusal really to take advice. You know, these, it seems to me, are personality defects, and they really are a virtue, it seems to me, a very strong virtue of Errol's film. I mean, I think the film will be criticized, as I should emphasize, the McNamara film was in its time, for not, as it were, nailing Rumsfeld, you know, not getting him. These people at this point, looking back over the desert produced by his policies and those of George W. Bush, want the satisfaction of seeing him nailed, you know, nailed down. And you can watch the film and feel, well, that didn't really happen. But nonetheless, in my view, it exposes the way he thinks, the way he talks, his self-regard. And one other thing we should say, I think, the Iraq War was an intellectual's war. You know,
yes.
It was a war that was fought in the cause of an idea.
Yeah, thank you, Paul Wolfowitz.
Well, this is true. And all these people, it doesn't necessarily mean it was a smart war, but it was a war fought, and it wasn't a smart war, but it was a war fought about ideas. And I think...
Remind us of the main idea, the propelling idea.
Well, I think the propelling idea underneath it all was at least my choice. You know, you could pick several because the war was certainly overdetermined. But I would put aside weapons of mass destruction, which was the public argument used, as Wolfowitz said, for bureaucratic reasons. And I would point to a phrase, creative destabilization, a wonderful phrase, notion that we have to go into the Middle East and we have to bust that stuff up. You know, it's a cauldron of these awful boiling hatreds, and the power of the United States has to be deployed to start a different process, to start a democratic tsunami. Now, this doesn't mean that these people were, you know, dedicated Democrats. I don't believe that. But I do believe that they thought that they could start a kind of process of change. Many of them did. Wolfowitz is the most notable. And they also wanted to restore, and this I think is very important, the prestige of the United States, the credibility of the United States. Terrorism, as Menachem Begin, the former Israeli prime minister and terrorist, said, is about dirtying the face of power. And September 11th very much dirtied the face of American power. And, you know, seeing tanks, American tanks, rumbling down the streets of a major Arab capital city was one of the ways that Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush himself thought you would clean the dirtied face of power. You would restore credibility. And I think this was very much in their minds. Henry Kissinger said he was for the Iraq war because we had to humiliate them the way they tried to humiliate us.
We're talking about the Iraq war this hour on the occasion of a new film about it, Errol Morris's portrait of George W. Bush's Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson joins us. You were a respected Army lifer, Colonel Wilkerson, at the top of Colin Powell's staff in the State Department. You made yourself a sort of one-man truth squad about the way policy was being made in Washington, policy for Iraq. And we interviewed you back in 2005. The lead in our conversation at that time was roughly that, for whatever reason, Donald Rumsfeld won every bureaucratic power struggle. Why? And how?
I think it was probably about 18 months before my boss figured out what I got and took as gospel, but couldn't really put it across as gospel until there was proof positive of it from Bill Seidman, who you may recall was Gerry Ford's economic advisor, very close to Gerry Ford. They grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan together. They were very close. And then he was Ronald Reagan's economic advisor, and he was head of the FDIC, and he finished up sort of as managing the biggest scandal, domestic scandal, of the Reagan administration, the savings and loan scandal, as head of the Resolution Trust Corporation. I had lunch with him at his request very early on, right after I'd been sworn in February 2001. And Bill, at the lunch, said, "I want to warn you about a member of your administration." Hmm. And I was all ears. And he said, "It's Donald Rumsfeld. I watched him in the Ford administration very closely. He is a congenital liar. He's brilliant. He's a infighter in terms of the bureaucracy, second only to Cheney. And he's very dangerous, perhaps the most dangerous man in the government." As far as I was concerned, that was good information, but there was no way I was going to be able to convince my boss of that. I think, as I said, it took 18 months of experience before he figured it out, and even more so figured out the alliance between the vice president and the secretary of defense, and Condi's, Dr. Rice's, utter inability to manage the decision-making process within the formal NSC, and it was a battle from then on out. And it seemed to me what motivated Rumsfeld more than anything else, and this really is something to watch, was not the bigger issue that might be a subject of an NSC meeting, it might be the subject of a principal's meeting or whatever. That faded for Rumsfeld. What was important was the immediate bureaucratic struggle and him winning it, almost like a wrestling match, almost like a boxing match or whatever. Mm. So what became important for him was not the bigger issue, it was winning the immediate tactical battle. and then exploiting that in however way he could to aggrandize his own power. And it worked. It worked for a long time, particularly because of the alliance between him and the vice president.
I want to play just another little bit of Rumsfeld tape because it's a little scary to hear him in Errol Morris's movie shouting down the facts from Baghdad, shouting down also the Pentagon press that was supposed to know something about the whole scene.
I picked up a newspaper today, and I couldn't believe it. I read 8 headlines that talked about chaos, violence, unrest, and it just was henny penny. The sky is falling. I've never seen anything like it. And here is a country that's being liberated. Here are people who are going from being repressed and held under the thumb of a vicious dictator, and they're free. And all this newspaper could do with 8 or 10 headlines, they showed a man bleeding, a civilian who they claimed we had shot, one thing after another. It's just unbelievable how people can take that away from what is happening in that country.
Did Colin Powell have a chance to, rub shoulders with Donald Rumsfeld in the corridor after that and say, Don, what were you talking about?
I think by that time it was more of his walking into my office and saying, can you believe that? Can you believe that? Although we both recognized at that time how deft he was at asking rhetorical questions and answering them himself, at creating the sort of image that got him, for example, at one time, as I recall, polling as the sexiest old man in America. He was quite good at these press conferences. He didn't do it the way it was usually done. He was no Chuck Hagel. He was no Bill Perry. He was no Bill Cohen. He was Donald Rumsfeld. He was the guy that sent out 20,000 memos and covered his ass on any issue you might ever bring up. You could bring up the Arctic zone and search and rescue, and he would reach in his desk and grab the snowflake that he had created to cover that contingency. And it would usually have an alternative that covered the opposite contingency. So he was always able to say, I thought of that.
Brilliant. Yeah. I wrote a memo about that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. In hindsight, he doesn't, for example, when Saddam Hussein said, let's be clear about something, I don't have nuclear weapons and I'm not interested in Al-Qaeda. And reporters asked Rumsfeld, well, what about it? And he did. He had talk about paraphrases or evasions or not quite saying anything, but he carried the day by saying, well, are you going to believe the village liar? He didn't quite say we have clear evidence to the contrary. But again, the big puzzle is how he got away with it. You say 18 months. It was 18 months before Colin Powell realized what he had in the cabinet with him. That gets you well into what summer, fall of 2002. And the war is being ramped, into readiness.
And you begin doing, you're an 800-pound gorilla, too. You've got a 200-pound gorilla in Condi, maybe not even that, who can't manage the process. And so everyone begins skirting the process. You go try to get the president's ear, whether it's on Air Force One, which it was one time with regard to North Korea, whether it's in the time you have with the president alone in the Oval, maybe only Andrew Card's there, but everyone's skirting the system. Therefore, nothing gets thoroughly vetted, and the vice president loves the hell out of it because he's really making the decisions.
Give us, I want a movie scene out of your own memory of Colin Powell, who doesn't suffer fools gladly, and Donald Rumsfeld. Any kind of sort of man-to-man moments.
Do I wish it?
No, I want you to reenact one or two of them for us.
Well, the most vivid moment for me was when he left my door cracked one day, and I'm not sure he was aware of it, and he was on the telephone talking first to Condi and then to Donald directly because clearly he couldn't get Condi to do anything. And it was about torture in general. It was about Guantanamo. It was a whole series of things that were really damaging our reputation internationally and causing things to happen that were adverse in terms of our national security interest. And he was trying to get Donald to understand that we needed to stop doing them. And, of course, the Pentagon was doing a lot of them, or at least perpetrating a lot of them. And he got frustrated and essentially at the top of his voice, or very nearly there, and I didn't hear him do that very often, said, "Don't you understand what you're doing, Don? Don't you understand what's happening to our reputation in the world? Don't you understand what we're doing?" And I couldn't hear the other side of the conversation, but I could only imagine it was, you know, more rope-a-dope. One of his favorite techniques at NSC meetings was to be uninformed and not knowing what was coming up. Therefore, he didn't have to offer any views, or he didn't have to make any decisions or offer any advice that was fundamental. He could then go back to the Pentagon and get smart on the issue, or more often than not, the decision had already been made by the vice president. So all he was doing was, you know, tying up the formal decision-making process.
He hasn't given up entirely on the notion that he had a strategic vision, a vision of a reformed army, leaner, meaner, fast-striking, in, out, quick, this sort of thing, but that when the moment came, he hadn't had enough time to prepare army.
The principal strategic vision he had was apparent right off the bat, because I started the joint staff talks for Richard Haass, whom I was working for at that time with the policy planning staff. I was the only one with military experience, so he said, go do what George Marshall and George Kennan did, start joint staff talks with the Pentagon. So I did. And what I realized immediately was the first priority of Donald Rumsfeld was not adapting to the so-called revolution in military affairs or building a precision-guided missile military. It was ballistic missile defense. And did we bite that one big? I mean, before we knew it, we were abrogating the anti-ballistic missile treaty, sticking our finger in every allied eye in Europe, most prominently the Germans, and sticking our eyes in Moscow, our hands in Moscow's eyes, too, because we were going to unilaterally abrogate the treaty. Powell had to do a lot of damage control on that one. He used to say he cleaned the dog poop off the Oval Office carpet. Well, that was a big pile of poop. And that was their first priority, was killing the anti-ballistic missile treaty so that we could deploy $100 billion. Thank you, Lockheed Martin. Thank you, Raytheon. Thank you, General Dynamics. Of ballistic missiles around the world when the technological proof wasn't even there for their validity and their operational effectiveness.
I want to draw Mark Garner back in. Mark, if only because I wonder, should we unearth the young Donald Rumsfeld, a congressman who wanted out of Vietnam and wrote about it, who also had a special sort of diplomatic mission for Ronald Reagan into the Middle East in the early mid-80s, and came back advising that the United States had to pull back from that swamp. Never American boots be down in the Middle East. I mean, was this a compulsive memo writer, or was there some sort of erratic system?
I think it was a brilliant tactic. You know, he lost control of it. But as I said before, it was to have a record, a proof of the brilliance that he had brought to a problem. Whether it had resolved the problem or not was irrelevant. It most often didn't. But it was to have this proof ready to be pulled out that he had actually thought about it. And since he thought about it in 10 different alternative ways, he could pull out one of them and throw it down on the table. Obviously, the other nine wouldn't come out, and say, see, here's the solution. I was prescient. I was very far-seeing. I had foresight. See here, this is... But he never solved the problem in the first place.
He still thinks he's prescient. Mark Danner, what's your take on that?
Well, I think I agree with the Colonel that I think a lot of his effort was directed toward tactical gains. There's no question about it. Winning the bureaucratic battles, protecting his turf. And then if you look at his so-called strategic vision, it tends to be very, very thin. I mean, there's a memo that Errol Morris has him read in the movie in which he says, you know, if we don't upend the regime of Saddam and one or two other countries in our response to the attacks, we will have failed. One or two other countries. I mean, this is not a very specific way to think about foreign affairs and military strategy. But nonetheless, he fancied himself and fancies himself a strategist. There is a memo that you referred to about the swamp, about the Middle East in 1983. And actually, one of the things I mourn that's missing from the movie is that his real role is as Ronald Reagan's Middle East envoy, which is prominently featured in the film. His real role was to manage a detente or an entente with Saddam Hussein and prepare the way for the United States under the Reagan administration to help fund Saddam's war against the Iraqis. And, you know, that's kind of scanted in the movie, which is, I think, a great pity, because the story of what has happened since is underlain by that policy choice, you know, getting close to Saddam. Then Saddam thinks he has a green light to invade Kuwait. I mean, we look back and we see the same players involved and so on. And Rumsfeld was at the beginning of that. But that also, as far as strategy, was not very deeply thought out. So I do agree with the Colonel. You know, he fancies himself a strategic thinker, but he's very much a man concerned with his own ambition, his own bureaucratic, tactical success, in search of issues that he can embrace. And military modernization was one of those. You know, he seized from, his army chief of staff, the idea of moving the army from a division-based to a brigade-based system. Now, he had no particular views about that, but he liked the idea. And this was very often what he did. You know, he's ambitious to make changes, but he didn't have very strong feelings about what changes to make. He was driven, I think, very much by personal driving ambition and by promoting American power.
Mark Danner, I want to introduce, and Colonel Wilkerson, I want to introduce your sometime colleague in Central America, Mark, Steve Kinzer. Steve, in our studio, you had been an esteemed New York Times correspondent in Turkey, also in Berlin, also in Iran. You'd covered wars in Latin America. By now, since all of that, you've written a series of, to my mind, marvelous linked studies of American interventions in Guatemala, Iran in the 50s, Cuba and the Congo into the 60s, and now your new book, an important double biography of the brothers, John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State in the Eisenhower 50s, and Alan Dulles, his brother in the CIA. It's always puzzled me, Steve, if I may say this straight ahead, why you weren't assigned by the Times to cover the Iraq war from the field, or at least to kick the tires of the policy back in Washington. I'm especially interested in your observations on the coverage of Donald Rumsfeld and what seems his protected standing to this day.
The entire performance of the press in the run-up to the Iraq war really is a shameful page in the history of this institution. It's not anything new. You can look back at the War of 1898, the Spanish-American War, when the Hearst Yellow Press whipped up American fervor.
You send me the pictures, I'll send you the war, right?
The same thing happened during the Dulles era. We then had a pretty broad consensus, and the press was completely complicit in keeping things secret and promoting fake narratives that came out of the White House and the Secretary of State's office. And the same thing happened in the run-up to the Iraq War. The idea was the American people are a team. The president is the captain of the team. Everyone in the United States has a role on this team. The churches have their role. Public institutions have their role. And the press has its role. And our role on the team was to make sure that Americans would support what Rumsfeld and his friends were planning. This is a complete misunderstanding of what the press is supposed to be and do. We are not on anybody's team. We are supposed to be apart from the team. But there's such an eagerness to perform as a kind of a stenographer to power that somebody like Rumsfeld, who actually is not that interesting a person, is so fascinating in the Washington milieu that somehow people got seduced by him and lost their sense of reason. It's really a great example of how the miasma of Washington allows people to forget what's happening in the rest of the world. People who cover Washington tend to think that if they've called the State Department and the Defense Department and somebody in Congress, they've covered the world. The idea that they should actually go out into the world beyond Washington is something that they don't
but
do.
Let's just remember, it was not always thus. I mean, I worked for James Reston of the New York Times. He was always, you know, in the pocket in a certain way of the Secretary of State, always close to Nelson Rockefeller and others. At the same time, in the same period, David Halberstam told the colonels giving the briefings in Vietnam, "Sir, with all due respect, I do not work for you. I am not on your team." And they and Halberstam explicitly raised this team protest. On the other hand, comes the war, the approach of the war in Iraq, and Dan Rather saying, you know, in so many words, these words, show me where I sign up. There was a suspension of disbelief, a suspension of, I don't know, professional standards of every kind, and I'm still marveling at it. And the New York Times has not recovered, it seems to me, for me as a reader. I mean, is there a...
Après moi le déluge, after I left. Look what happened.
Well, I always thought, I mean, I still think, if Steve Erlanger and you and Chris Hedges had been on that war, it would have been a different story in the New York Times. It might have been a different story in the world. We're talking about Donald Rumsfeld in the light of Errol Morris's new movie, The Unknown Known, with Stephen Kinzer, late of the New York Times, now of a marvelous book called The Brothers, about the Dulleses, with Colonel Lawrence Wilkinson, who was the right hand of Colin Powell, and with Mark Danner, who's written a long, endless series on Donald Rumsfeld in the New York Review. And then this is all prelude to Cheney. Before we get into the rest of it, I just want to play some of that memo you alluded to, Mark Danner. It's Donald Rumsfeld. This is from the movie. It's his memo of strategic thoughts.
September 30th, 2001. Memorandum titled Strategic Thoughts. The U.S. strategic theme should be aiding local peoples to rid themselves of terrorists and to free themselves of regimes that support terrorism. The regimes of such states should see that it will be fatal to host terrorists who attack the United States. The United States government should envision a goal along these lines. New regimes in Afghanistan and another key state or two that supports terrorism. Syria out of Lebanon. Dismantlement or destruction of weapons of mass destruction capabilities. If the war does not significantly change the world's political map, the U.S. will not achieve its aim.
Another key state or two, he said, Steve Kinzer. I mean, how's that for audacity?
It really reflects a sense that the world can be managed from Washington, and you don't need to know anything about any countries that are out there in the world. It also goes back to an idea that I think we're still captive of in America, which is that there's a natural process, the end of which is that all countries are going to wind up being like us. They all want to be, and it's the natural course of history. Therefore, we're only helping them to do what fate and destiny and all of the people in those countries have already decided is right. There's no concept that other people live in other ways and see the world differently. You know, there's a tremendous pull in Washington to feel that we can dictate whatever goes on in the world. And I think people sitting around, putting their feet up on the desks and thinking of how they'd like to see the Middle East change translates into a real feeling that we can do this, that we can go out into the world and with violence pacify countries in the world. If Rumsfeld thought that we would not achieve our goals in the world if we failed, he turned out to be right, because we failed and we have not achieved the goals that he wanted to achieve. I actually think that's a good thing.
I think you could, if I might...
Mark Danner, please.
I think you can take Stephen Kinzer's point a step further here and say that the imperial thinking that's evidence in that memo and in the Bush administration policy in general after September 11th was precisely the wrong thing to do, which is to say that it was wrong in for what the country's interests were at that moment. The United States had been attacked by a small group, a small conspiratorial group. It hadn't been attacked by a large country. It had been attacked by Al Qaeda. And the wise policy was not to act in such a way as to give a boost both to Al Qaeda and to radical or fundamentalist jihadists, whatever you'd like to call them. And instead, we essentially chose as a policy choice, the Bush administration, led by Cheney and Rumsfeld, chose a policy that was almost precisely wrong because it involved occupying a major Arab country and, in the event, repressing on television day after day Muslims. Not only repressing them, but torturing them. And gosh, the Americans even brought their own cameras to show that. And, you know, when you look back at this policy, what is striking is, and this gets back to Stephen Kinzer's point, that it was about us, not about the problem and solving it. It was about reinforcing an imperial position, reinforcing imperial power, reinforcing the idea of the United States that Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld had essentially grown up with. Mm. And it was singularly detrimental to the country. And if I could add something about the point about the press, you know, I was very critical of the press before the war. I argued against it with various members of it, including Hal Raines. But I think we should point out...
Who else? Just remind us, Mark. I mean, who did you debate on?
Trevor Hitchens, Leon Wieseltier. I had a series of debates about the war. And I think, but I want to speak a little bit, not in favor of it, but in some mitigation. The first point, obviously, to bring up is 9/11, is that the press is kind of jingoistic, and the jingoistic feeling in the country, nationalistic feeling, that the press to some extent reflected and shouldn't have, obviously. But secondly, that the administration was very clever in making its argument on intelligence grounds. And when it comes to intelligence information, the press very often finds itself acting like seals, you know, clapping its hands together, wanting the fish to be thrown out by sources. Judith Miller is the most egregious example of this. But it puts the information management very much in the hands of the administration. And when it became a story about intelligence, about what Saddam has and what he secretly has and what only the intelligence agencies know, this put the administration in a relatively strong position. I mean, having said that, you know, I agree completely that the press's performance was terrible. There's no question at all about that. But the last point to make, and I think it's relevant to the Rumsfeld movie, is that, you know, the press operates best when you have policymakers and people in Congress, you know, members of the elite, who oppose the central policy. And the problem with running up to the war is any Democratic politician who is ambitious, who planned to run for president, supported the war.
Yeah.
If Hillary Clinton and John Kerry and various other people had been violently against the war and in a position to give information or at least interviews to members of the press, you would have had a real opposition at the elite level. And the problem is, though you had an opposition to the war in the streets, people marching in the streets, the elite in Washington was, relatively speaking, I mean, obviously this isn't universal, but relatively speaking, united, in part because of the Gulf War beforehand, when Democrats had been against it and they felt themselves, you know, caught out with their pants down when the war was quick and thought to be successful. So you didn't have a division among the elite. And it is, in part, when we look at this movie, you know, I think there is, regarding Iraq still, a kind of shame in the country because the war, when it was begun, was popular, insofar as you can tell that by polls.
Well, that's an argument, but we've got to talk about it. There is a shame in the country around this issue. But you also remind me, you know, in Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam time, there was also, strangely enough, George Ball always hanging around the administration, and he was known to be highly critical of the war. And there were others, but there was room. I wonder, this is a question for Colonel Wilkerson, what if Colin Powell had made it clear, and he had ways, including you, Larry Wilkerson, that this policy is out of control, makes no sense. Well, it's not what it seems.
Let me say one thing. I agree with most of what Mark said and what Steve said, but I do want to point out that Knight Ridder, now McClatchy, was pretty good and pretty consistent, and they became my go-to people for trying to get an alternative view out.
So that's where they got it.
Yeah, I think, well, no, but I think they did a fairly good job. And let me say also that the two other countries were not nebulous. I went to briefings in Doug Feist's shop, and I went to briefings before the Pentagon kicked me out, Rumsfeld kicked me out, and stopped the joint staff talks. The other two countries were clear. They were North Korea and Iran. And it's a long story, pretty easy to figure out, not all that difficult, not rocket science, as to why we didn't do North Korea. And I think fairly simple to figure out why we didn't Iran, too, although the case is not so obvious. But that's what I was hearing. I would come back to policy planning meetings, and I would sit there, you know, trying to figure out, what the hell are we doing? We're going to war with three different countries, or at least it looks like we're doing significant contingency planning for war with three different countries. This was not smart. Conservation of enemies is a real principle of foreign relations. You don't want any more enemies you can handle at any one time. And we were doing some pretty stupid things.
Mark, I want you all to come back to Mark's point about a certain shame in the country. I mean, it surfaces in odd moments, but when John Kerry is dressing down Vladimir Putin for stepping on Crimea, and all he has to say is, and we all know it, John, you voted for a war not next door that was always part of our world, as Crimea has always been part of the Russian world, thousands of other miles away on the other side of the earth that had not threatened us directly. I mean, there is a kind of embarrassment that hangs over not only our democracy, but our policymakers to this day. And I'm wondering, sort of, when the press is not a bulwark of outspoken criticism and opposition, where do we look? How do we address it?
Emotion is always the enemy of sound foreign policy making. And as Mark pointed out, we were caught up in emotion at that time because of the emotions of 9/11. You know, it takes me back to something I used to tell my little girl when she was growing up. I used to say, now, don't forget your life is not shaped by what happens to you. It's shaped by how you react to what happens to you. I told her this year after year. I never thought that this was a foreign policy principle, but now I'm beginning to realize that it actually applies to foreign policy as well.
That's an extremely good point. I mean, it is possible to look at a kind of egotism, a self-centered, blinkered quality that was, it's part of American foreign policy. Maybe it's part of the imperial view in general, but it was certainly absolutely unmissable after September 11th. It dominated thinking. I should point out also, while the point's in the air, that Colonel Wilkerson's point about Iran and North Korea, anyone who reads Gates's memoirs or Condoleezza Rice's knows that Vice President Cheney was still fighting for those wars, particularly the Iranian one, and also for attacking Syria long into the second Bush administration. So that policy in the mind of the vice president, at least, although his power was waning at that time, was still very much present.
Very much so. Very much so. And I think he saw Syria as a backdoor into Iran.
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to launch, in what little time we have, at least a notion of a more wider, more popular, slower, agonizing reappraisal. I'm thinking of a book I treasure, certainly a book for the desert island, Louis Menand's The Metaphysical Club. It was about the aftermath of the Civil War in this country. The striking parallel, as I read it, between Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. of the New England patrician elite leaving Harvard to answer Lincoln's first call for volunteers in 1861. 100 years later, almost to the day, John Kerry leaves Yale answering the call for volunteers. It was actually 1966. He's just out of Yale, but he goes into that war. And as we know, he became a famous witness against it. The difference is that the Oliver Wendell Holmes, who nearly died in the Civil War, came back and dedicated his whole life to a pragmatic philosophy in the law and in life. John Kerry, alas, stumbled into politics, and I'm not sure he's found his way ever since. But it seems to me the achievement of William James, John Dewey, Charles Peirce, and Oliver Wendell Holmes, among others, in thinking through a horrific mistake dedicated to the notion, let's not do that again. We're ready for that kind of sort of long public seminar with our better angels. Steve Kinzer, do you want to chair it?
We are not ready for that seminar. I don't think Americans are good at this. We don't like to do this.
We were in the 19th century.
I look back at
William James's cautions live.
Look back at the era of the Dulles brothers. The Dulles brothers were hugely powerful in the 1950s. They could make and break governments, and they did. There probably wasn't a living human being who was literate on Earth who didn't know the name Dulles. Now, the Dulles brothers are almost completely forgotten. We've airbrushed them out of our history. Rather than try to look at what they did and see if we can draw some lessons from them, we've just tried to forget them. And we're doing that again.
You've written a very good book about him, Steve, and they'll be famous again. Colonel Wilkerson, what about a kind of national retreat to think about this place we're in, an imperial power run amok?
Well, let me say first that I agree with what Steve just said. I just taught Alan Dulles and John Foster, Alan with respect to a number of covert ops and John Foster with respect to the Suez Canal crisis and other episodes in the Eisenhower administration. I couldn't agree with Steve more. But to your question, I think it's impossible with this democracy, if it is a democracy anymore. I really think it's impossible. I think Gore Vidal was right. We're the United States of amnesia. And it is impossible to learn a lesson when you don't have any affection for, let alone knowledge of, your own history.
Mark Danner, lead us out of the thicket here, and it's a big one.
Well, I'd say, first of all, that John Kerry, of course, is the wrong generation to look for. There may well be the equivalent, we hope this is true, of Oliver Wendell Holmes and William James in the generation that perhaps fought in Iraq or at least lived through it. I mean, this is, as Stephen Kinzer said, this is very early. I mean, we are in the penumbra still. We are living still in the penumbra of the Iraq War, though we don't talk about it. When you look at President Barack Obama's light footprint,
let's talk about him.
Forces over the horizon, his enormous use, which have killed several thousand people at least, of unmanned aerial vehicles or drones, for a foreign policy where you bring the troops home, you bring the tanks home, but you fight it out of mind and out of sight, and you kill a lot of people, but at least they're not Americans dying. That is a policy that's directly produced by the Bush era of those two wars. And just as Barack Obama was produced by the unpopularity of George W. Bush and the fact that he was the only one as a senator in Springfield, Illinois, to oppose the Iraq War. So we're still in this world, even though we don't want to talk about it. And, you know, when we talk about drones, when we talk about Afghan policy, we are looking at a president in Obama who is forced to deal with the problems left to him by his predecessor. And I noticed that Obama is quoted as saying in a recent book, that it turns out, he said, on the day he killed by drone Anwar al-Awlaki, it turns out I'm pretty good at killing people. Who would have thought that that would be my strong suit? And in fact, it has turned out he's been good at killing people out of sight and out of mind.
Yeah.
And Americans are perfectly willing to have him do it.
Mark Danner, this is a melancholy note to end on, but there we are, even with Colonel Wilkerson questioning whether it's still a democracy, not to mention the amnesia. Thank you all. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, Steve Kinzer, Mark Danner. Listeners, you can continue the conversation about the Iraq War and its aftermath on our website. Look for What's Known, What's Unknown, and What We Don't Want to Know. You'll find us at radioopensource.org. You can also find a podcast conversation with Phil Clay, a Marine, author of a marvelous new book of short stories about Iraq. It's called Redeployment. Also, the latest entry in our Reading Chekhov stories. The new story is The Teacher of Literature, and it's great. Next week, we'll be thinking through the thermonuclear monarchy with the literary strategist, Elaine Scarry. The show was produced by Kunal Jasti, our engineer, George Hicks, and Max Larkin, who gets double credit this week. One is a producer on Errol Morris's Donald Rumsfeld film. One is Lieutenant on our squad. Mary McGrath is our commander-in-chief. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next week for Open Source.